Do you know what time it is? It's supernatural story time. And if you're easily scared, and even if you're not, there's only one thing left to do. Just turn off the lights, because these are stories that you listen to only in the dark.
A haunted farmhouse by the courtesy of Miss Estelle Stead. This is the account of a haunted farmhouse at Oakville, a small town on the Savannah River. And like the rocking chair, the story hails from the South, where environment seems favorable for psychic manifestations. As a matter of fact, until now, American ghost stories are not plentiful, but there must be an unexploited mine of wealth for an enterprising and painstaking psychic prospector, especially since dangerous living and swift dying have become everyday occurrences in the USA. Some years ago, Mr. Walsingham, a gentleman farmer, bought a farm which on the surface appeared to be a very good investment. And for a few months after the Walsinghams moved in, they were not troubled by any kind of disturbances. Then, unaccountable noises made sleep impossible. Furniture was overturned, and the doorbell pealed loudly and incessantly. The Walsinghams, being practical people, looked for a practical reason for these troubles, which they decided arose through mischievous neighbors. But this sensible solution soon had to be definitely abandoned. One particular inmate of the farm who resented these nightly upheavals more than anyone else was a huge mastiff, Don Caesar by name, whose life was made unbearable by perpetual wakefulness. And at last his temper began to show signs of wear and tear. No doubt he argued that although the duty of a house dog was to protect the life and property of his owners, he could not be expected to cope with invisible intruders. Don Caesar's fate was tragic. One morning he was found in the hall, barking loudly, bristling with rage, his eyes fixed on somebody facing him. At last he leaped forward, only to fall back, throttled and flung down by a powerful hand. His neck was broken. The sinister presence was on the best of terms with the house cat, and while dogs either show the extremes of rage or fear when they come up against the supernatural, cats, on the contrary, positively enjoy psychic phenomena, and I've often seen a cat intent on watching something unseen by others, its eyes following the something's every movement. Thus, the Walsingham cat would stand near one of the doors as if showing some visitor in, and it occasionally climbed into a vacant chair, purring and rubbing itself against the invisible occupant. But the cat's strange behavior was infinitely preferable to what happened afterwards. One night, when Amelia Walsingham was brushing her hair and creaming her face before going to bed, she felt a hand laid softly on her shoulder, and thinking it to be that of her mother or sister, she glanced in the mirror, at first to see no reflection but her own. She looked again. A man's hand was lying on her arm, a hideous hand, covered on the back with a growth of coarse black hair. The terrified girl's continuous screaming brought her family upstairs, but when they arrived, there was no sign of the hand, and Amelia, told by everyone that she must have dreamt it, began to think she had dropped off to sleep, and that the hand had only been part of a nightmare. Mr. Walsingham, however, was no dreamer of dreams, and one morning, after a light shower, when he was walking in the pleasant garden, which sloped down to the river's edge, he noticed footsteps forming beside his own, which showed up plainly in the light soil. The footsteps were those of a man's naked feet. The same evening, another incident occurred when some friends were having supper with the Walsinghams, and a loud groan proceeded from the room overhead. Everyone looked at his or her neighbor, but although the groan was not repeated, Mrs. Walsingham noticed a mark of something moist and red staining the white tablecloth. Where did it come from? She looked upwards and saw a liquid slowly dripping on the table from the ceiling. Everyone stopped eating to watch the slow descent of the red drops, and then Mr. Walsingham and his guest ran upstairs to the room directly over the dining room to discover the source of this horrible dripping. The floor of the room was completely covered, but wishing to satisfy himself thoroughly, Mr. Walsingham ripped up the carpet, only to find the boards perfectly dry and covered with a thin top layer of dust. There was no trace of any blood. While the floor was being examined, those below still saw the continuous drip, drip, and a stain the size of a large plate formed before it ceased. The stain was examined next day under the microscope and pronounced to be human blood. The Walsingham left the farm as soon as possible, and the premises were given over to the unseen. All kinds of stories were now current, and Horace Gunn, one of the bright young people of Oakville, accepted a wager that he would not pass 24 hours alone in the haunted house. He eventually did so, but he said afterward that not all the money in the USA would tempt him to pass another night there. This is what happened. Horace Gunn arrived at the farm shortly after twilight and set to work to kindle a fire in one of the rooms. He had provided himself with a lamp, but when he tried to light it, an icy breath from someone standing by his side extinguished each match as soon as he struck it. The same thing happened with the fire. This unexpected commencement would have provided a good excuse for him to forfeit the wager and make tracks for Oakville, but the wager was considerable, and although Horace Gunn was afraid of ridicule, he was sufficiently courageous to make up his mind to sit it out. For some time, all was quiet, when suddenly a yell of pain came from the cellars under the house. This was the signal for a general pandemonium. Running feet passed up and down the stairs as if some person were fleeing in fear of their life from the pursuit of a second. This frenzied chase lasted well over an hour. Then it ceased, and Horace, alone in the darkness, devoutly hoped that the manifestations were over. All at once his attention was held by a luminous white spot, which gradually materialized on the opposite wall and continued to lighten until it shone at last as a disk of white fire, and the terrified watcher saw that the light encircled a human head, which, without any body or means of support, was moving slowly along the wall, about the height of a man from the floor. This dreadful head was covered with long gray hair, matted together over one temple with clots of blood from a jagged wound. The expression of the face was one of incalculable suffering and misery, and the wide-open eyes, glowing with unearthly fire, were fixed on Horace Gunn, until the head finally disappeared and the room was once more in darkness. It was impossible to remain in the place any longer, and Horace Gunn pulled himself sufficiently together to try and make his way out. It is easy to imagine his apprehension as he groped his way inch by inch along the wall, wondering what horror his outstretched hand might encounter, dreading to see what he believed filled the room. And he had nearly reached the door when he was seized by the ankle and thrown violently to the ground. Clammy hands felt for his throat, and notwithstanding his struggles, he was choked into insensibility. When morning rode high in a cloudless heaven, some of Horace Gunn's light-hearted friends drove out from Oakville to see what had happened to the ghost seer. As they approached the farm, they were surprised not to be met by Horace with a demand for spot cash payment of the wager. Nobody was visible, and when their knocking remained unanswered, the cynical amongst the party decided that, after all, Horace, unable to see things through, had vamoosed. However, the spirit of fair play insisted he would be only sporting to force an entrance. This was done, and the young men hurried into the dining room, where they discovered Horace, who for a few moments they imagined to be dead, lying on the floor, and bending over him, they noticed that his black and swollen throat was covered with the marks of long, thin fingers terminated by hooked nails. Horace Gunn was brought round with some difficulty, but he never recovered from the shock of his dearly bought experience as a psychic investigator, and the farm was abandoned to the evil entities who possessed it. All kinds of reasons have been put forward to account for these hideous manifestations, especially as, to the best of everyone's knowledge, the farm's past for the last 70 years was beyond suspicion. Previous to that period, something dreadful may have occurred that constitutes one of the many unrevealed tragedies which have no known history. One fact might have some bearing on the strange manifestations. 3 months after Mr. Walsingham purchased the farm, a quantity of bones were unearthed in a corner of a small plantation. These bones were declared to be those of a human being, but Mr. Walsingham thought otherwise, and the bones were thrown into an adjacent lime kiln and quickly consumed. The hauntings did not begin until after the discovery and disposal of the bones, so perhaps the outraged spirit of the person to whom they belong in life may have resented such summary treatment and punished the Walsinghams in this manner. This strange story is well authenticated, and long accounts appeared in the press when the hauntings became generally known, especially as Mr. Gunn's account of the wager and its result provided South Georgia with plenty of food for thought and conversation. I have included it in this collection of ghost stories, as it presents many similarities between psychic disturbances as we know them in the mother country. The ways of cats and dogs are alike all the world over. The noises are also familiar, and the sensation of cold is never disassociated from certain manifestations. The horrors are perhaps a little on the American side, but on the other hand, many haunted houses in England excel the Grand Guignol in gruesome happenings. Be that as it may, the psychic history of the Oakville farmhouse is undoubtedly well worth recording. Next story. Some clerical ghost stories by the courtesy of Miss Ella Stead. First, the pursuer, the Reverend H. Elwin Thomas's experience. Some years ago, the Reverend H. Elwin Thomas was acting as second minister on a Wesleyan circuit in the South Wales district. The circuit consisted of 8 churches, and Mr. Thomas had to preach in each of them once a month, beginning his ministrations at Llanelly. From there, he went to Crick Howell, arriving at Langnier about 6 in the evening. A good hiker, Mr. Thomas usually did the distance between these places on foot. One fine Sunday evening in June, Mr. Thomas told a friend with whom he usually stayed at Langnier that he would not be back at his house until 9 o'clock, as he intended walking part of the way home with some other acquaintances. At 9:20, Mr. Thomas said goodnight to his friends and was making his way back when he saw what he thought to be a beggar standing on the banks of the canal, which runs parallel for 6 miles with the particular road. The canal and the road were lonely. The nearest house was 1/4 mile away. The intense stillness of a summer night brooded over everything, and Mr. Thomas, wondering what had brought anyone to this spot at such an hour, stopped to have a good look. No sooner had he done so than he wished himself 1,000 miles away. Within 1/2 yard of him, he saw a startling and dreadful sight, that of an old man over whose face the leaden-colored skin was tightly stretched. The lips were thin and bloodless, and the half-open mouth toothless. 2 piercing and semi-luminous eyes, set far back, stared at Mr. Thomas, who could not avoid noticing that the beggar was dressed in a very peculiar way. Perhaps the word wrapped, not dressed, better describes 2 bands of stained calico, one of which passed under the old man's chin and was tied at the top of the head. The other was drawn round the forehead and fastened behind. So horrible was this extraordinary object that Mr. Thomas actually ran away from it. He was an absolute disbeliever in ghosts, and as he had no patience with any kind of superstition, it never occurred to him that the beggar was not of this world. And he only realized this when, after, as he thought, outdistancing the figure, he turned around to find it close behind him. Mr. Thomas looked up and down the road and the deserted canal banks. Not a soul was in sight. The night seemed only to hold him and his pursuer. By this time, the wrappings had merged into a column of intense blackness, and there was nothing visible between the face and the ground. Raising his umbrella in the unreasoning panic which seizes even the bravest, the minister hid out blindly, only to encounter air, through which his umbrella easily passed. Thoroughly frightened, Mr. Thomas once again took to his heels and ran as quickly as possible down a road which branches off the main road, going directly to the center of the village. And feeling that he had arrived at a spiritual crisis in his life, Mr. Thomas conquered his fear and confusion and spoke to the pursuer, whose footsteps made no sound on the silent highway. The thing had stopped in the center of the main road, and when secure in his newly found moral strength, the minister walked towards it. He saw it moving swiftly until it reached the lower end of the road, which runs parallel with the boundary wall of the churchyard, and then appeared to float over the wall and vanished in the dense foliage of an ancient yew tree near the lych gate, after this Mr. Thomas fainted. He came to himself 2 hours later, lying in the same place where he had fallen. He was very cold and he felt bodily ill. Fortunately, motor traffic on Sunday night was practically non-existent, otherwise he might easily have been run over by a passing vehicle. Picking himself out of the dust, Mr. Thomas took the road which led to the sanity and safety of human companionship. The reaction from this mental ordeal proved too much for the minister. It was over an hour before he reached his friend's home, barely a quarter of a mile away. When he did, his changed appearance alarmed his host and his daughter so much that the young girl screamed when she saw him, especially as Mr. Thomas was incapable of saying a word of explanation of his condition. He tried to speak, but his words ran into each other and formed an unintelligible babble of sound, and it was not before 5 in the morning that some kind of speech returned to the stricken minister, and then only in broken and meaningless sentences. After this, Mr. Thomas spent the whole of the following week in bed, laid up with a bad attack of nervous prostration. The strangest part of this strange story remains to be told. When Mr. Thomas was himself again, his host questioned him closely about the events of that unforgettable Sunday. "Did you notice anything particular about the place where you first saw the figure?" asked Mr. P. Mr. Thomas thought, and thought again. "Well," said he, "I seem to recollect a ruined cottage a little lower down." "Someone answering the description of your pursuer once lived there. He was by way of being a recluse, lost to all sense of personal respect and decency. His garments were a collection of odd lengths of indescribably filthy calico, and I believe he was buried in them, as owing to his reputation as a wizard, nobody would go near him during his last illness. He was buried in the exact spot in the churchyard where you saw the figure disappear, and the cottage, already ruinous, became more and more so until the greater part fell to the ground. It has never been rebuilt. During the time Mr. Thomas remained on the circuit, he never saw his pursuer again. Perhaps the spirit was made manifest to rebuke his obstinate disbelief in returns, and from that time the minister never discounted the reality of dwellers in the unseen world." It seems strange why ministers of any denomination should not believe in ghosts. There are endless stories of haunted cottages and vicarages, that of Epworth representing an epoch in the phenomena which I'm going to describe, which takes place at a vicarage near Cashel, have been experienced by the vicar himself. 20 years ago, soon after the vicar's arrival at D, his servants complained of odd noises in the top story of the house, and his wife had to change servants so often that at last the vicar spoke to the friendly parish priest as to, so he writes, "I suspected that the idea of ghosts might have been suggested to the maids by neighbors who had some interest in getting rid of them. After a while," continues the vicar, "my wife and I began to hear a noise which, while in no sense alarming, has proved to be both remarkable and inexplicable. This noise sounds like a heavy coach rumbling up to the hall door. Sometimes we hear it several times in the same night, and then perhaps we won't hear it again for months. We hear it best on calm nights, and as we are nearly a quarter of a mile from the high road, it makes difficult to account for." The vicar and his wife gradually became used to the phantom coach, but one hot July day, between 12 and 1, the vicar was cutting hay in a small field near the tennis court, which looked down the avenue for about 400 yards. Making any kind of hay while the scorching sun is shining must be tiring work. The vicar, pausing in his occupation, saw what appeared to be a high dog cart in which were 2 people turning in at the avenue gate. As he had discarded both his coat and waistcoat, he took cover behind a newly made haycock and watched the approach of the dog cart until a clump of trees and a turn in the drive hid it momentarily from view. It did not reappear, so, hastily putting on his coat, the vicar went as far as the bend in the avenue to investigate. Nothing was to be seen. Returning to the vicarage, the vicar told the housekeeper, an old servant of many years standing, what had occurred, and heard from her that she had seen the very same dog cart, but did not like to tell her master, as he would have laughed at her. All this happened in the summer, but when the winter of 1912 came, the vicar had another uncanny experience one dark evening when he was working at the engine of his car. The chauffeur gardener had gone down to the village with a message 10 minutes previously, so when the vicar heard heavy footsteps in the yard, coming over to the motor house, thinking them to be those of the man who had perhaps come back for something he had forgotten, he called out, "Hello, what's brought you back so soon?" There was no reply. Snatching up his electric lamp, the vicar made a thorough search of the motor house and the yard, but he could discover no one. A week later, he heard the footsteps again and renewed his search with no better results. According to the vicar, a number of people have heard the coach and some have felt it pass them, but there is no explanation and the manifestations still continue. In 1908, the vicarage of East Rudham, a small, unattractive village near Fakenham, witnessed a supernatural occurrence when the ghost of the living vicar appeared to three people: the vicar in charge, the vicarage housekeeper, and a maidservant. The Reverend Dr. Astley, who had left East Rudham to take the chaplaincy of Biskra for the winter months, was unfortunately detained in hospital at Algiers on his way to his new duties as a result of injuries received in a railway accident. The accident happened on December 10th, and the same afternoon, Mrs. Hartley, the housekeeper at the vicarage, was about to close the shutters in the vicar's study when she saw Dr. Astley coming across the lawn towards the window. The vicar was hatless, seemingly in the best of tempers, as he smiled at Mrs. Hartley and beckoned to her with a piece of paper he was holding. When a country vicar supposedly comfortably settled abroad returns home without any kind of warning, the mind leaps to the unusual, and Mrs. Hartley, to say the least of it, was flustered. However, when she opened the front windows, Dr. Astley made no attempt to come beyond a little recess, and thinking this rather strange, Mrs. Hartley called one of the maids. "Do you see anyone outside?" she asked, in which she hoped represented merely a casual inquiry. "Of course I do," said the girl. "Why, it's the Reverend, arrived sudden-like." "But why ever don't he come inside?" Mrs. Hartley, with admirable presence of mind, stopped any further surmises and told her subordinate to fetch Mr. Brock, who was deputizing for Dr. Astley at East Rudham. Partly enlightened by Mrs. Hartley's messenger as to the reason why he was wanted, Mr. Brock came to the study, and Mrs. Hartley, pointing finger, indicated the figure in the recess. Mr. Brock had only met Dr. Astley once, but he possessed a flair for details, and in a letter published in the Times of December 28, 1908, he described this extraordinary phantasm of the living. "When I was called into the study," he wrote, "I clearly saw the figure outside, which I recognized as that of Dr. Astley, who seemed to be sitting in a chair with some books before him. I noticed his cuddlesome collar and his way of wearing his watch chain straight across his waistcoat, high up. The figure had the appearance of a reflection in a mirror. The time was about 4:40 p.m. with no light in the room. I could see the figure quite clearly. It gradually vanished." One of the various facts connected with this return is that if the vicar had really been seated in his study with a light in the room, his reflection would have been seen in the window exactly as Mr. Brock described it. In order to make this living ghost story convincing, Dr. Astley ought to have passed at the time when he appeared on the vicarage lawns. But fortunately for his wife and his parishioners, he recovered from his severe bruises and returned to East Rudham as a substance and not as a shadow. The publication of Mr. Brock's letter aroused widespread interest, being corroborated by three independent witnesses. But there are quite recent instances of this kind of psychic phenomena, and the late Mr. W.T. Stead, in taking what he described as his senses of hallucinations, obtained some curious stories of ghosts of the living, two of them from clerical sources, the first given him by his old school fellow, the Reverend Mr. Talbot, whose mother possessed the faculty of seeing forms invisible to others. On this occasion, she saw a friend of hers coming up the garden path, but when she went to welcome her, Mrs. Lister, for this was her friend's name, had disappeared. Feeling certain that something had happened, Mr. and Mrs. Talbot hurried off to the Lister's house, where they found the unfortunate woman had been nearly killed by her husband in a sudden fit of insanity. No doubt in her terror extremity, Mrs. Lister had thought of her friend, and in some way or another, her visual phantasm had appeared in the Talbot's garden. The Reverend Father Fleming told Mr. Stead how two figures from Woolwich, the scene of his labors, appeared to him when he was staying in Dublin, saying that they had died on certain dates, and begging him most earnestly to give them spiritual comfort. As the death dates had not yet come around, Father Fleming asked the figures what this meant. He was informed that it had been done to fix his attention, and the priest was so troubled that he asked his hostess to allow him to cut short his visit, as he felt obliged to return to Woolwich. On his arrival, he was immediately sent for by one of the ghosts, a stranger to him who was dangerously ill, and who died on the exact date mentioned at Dublin. The second summons came a few days later, and death ensued on the date predicted. The two men did not know each other, but curiously enough, in both cases, there was a great wrong to be undone, and both individuals had set their hearts on confiding the trouble to Father Fleming, who told Mr. Stead he regarded this experience in the light of a solemn warning. As her spiritual adviser, on no account to neglect the opportunity of saving two unhappy erring souls. 50 years ago, another Norfolk clergyman, the Reverend Dr. Jessop, met with a supernatural experience at Mannington Hall when he was on a visit to Lord Orford in order to consult some works of reference only to be found in the Mannington Hall library. Dr. Jessop and a party of four dined with Lord Orford, and at 11 o'clock, Dr. Jessop shut himself in the library and began work in earnest, comfortably seated at a table near the fire, poring over an ever-increasing pile of books by the light of four candles in tall silver candlesticks. At 1 o'clock, Dr. Jessop rested a while, opened the last volumes, and commenced his concluding notes. After this, I will let his own testimony, published in the pages of the Athenaeum, speak for itself. I had been engaged upon it about half an hour, says he, and I was just beginning to think that my work was drawing to a close, when, as I was actually writing, I saw a large white hand within a foot of my elbow. Turning my head, there sat the figure of a somewhat large man, bending slightly over the table and apparently examining the pile of books that I had been at work upon. The man's face was turned away from me, but I saw his closely cut reddish-brown hair, his ear and shaved cheek, the eyebrow, the corner of the right eye, the side of the forehead, and the large high cheekbone. He was dressed in what I can only describe as a kind of habit of thick corded silk, or some such material close up to the throat, with a narrow rim or edging of satin or velvet, about an inch broad, serving as a stand-up collar and fitting close to the chin. The right hand, which had first attracted my attention, was clasping, without any great pressure, the left hand. Both hands were in perfect repose, and the large blue veins of the left hand were conspicuous. I remember thinking that the hand was like the hand of Velázquez's magnificent Dead Knight in the National Gallery. I looked at my visitor for some seconds and was perfectly sure he was not a reality. 1,000 thoughts came crowding upon me, but not the least feeling of alarm or even uneasiness. Curiosity and a strong interest were uppermost. For an instant, I felt eager to make a sketch of my friend, and I looked at a tray on my right for a pencil. Then I thought, upstairs I have a sketchbook. Shall I fetch it? There he sat, and I was fascinated, afraid, not of his staying, but lest he should go. Stopping in my writing, I lifted my left hand from the paper, stretched it out to the pile of books, and moved the top one. I cannot explain why I did this. My arm passed in front of the figure, and it vanished. I was simply disappointed and nothing more. I went on with my writing as if nothing had happened, perhaps for another 5 minutes, and had actually got to the last few words of what I had determined to extract, when the figure appeared again, exactly in the same place and attitude as before. I saw the hands close to my own. I turned my head again to examine him more closely, and I was framing a sentence to address him when I discovered that I dared not speak. There he sat, and there sat I. I turned my head again to my work and finished writing the two or three words I had to write. The paper and my notes are at this moment before me and exhibit not the slightest tremor or nervousness. I could point out the words I was writing when the phantom came and when he disappeared. Having finished my task, I shut the book and threw it on the table. It made a slight noise as it fell. The figure vanished. Throwing myself back in my chair, I sat for some seconds looking at the fire with a curious mixture of feelings, and I remember wondering whether my friend would come again, and, if he did, whether he would hide the fire from me. Then first there stole upon me a dread and suspicion that I was beginning to lose my nerve. I remember yawning. Then I rose, lit my bedroom candle, took my books into the inner library, mounted the chairs before me, placed 5 of the volumes. The 6 I brought back and laid upon the table where I had been writing when the phantom did me the honor to appear to me. By this time I had lost all sense of uneasiness. I blew out the 4 candles and marched off to bed, where I slept the sleep of the just or the guilty, I know not which, but I slept very soundly. So ended Dr. Jessup's experience. I do not know whether Lord Orford gave him any explanation of the library ghost, but it says a good deal for Dr. Jessup's nerve that he was able to face the spiritual encounter calmly and to remember every detail connected with it. But he always insisted that during the whole of dinner no reference was made to occult subjects.